Chapter 17. Horrible. He went up to her, and an answering impulse made her lay a hand on his arm. He held it there a moment. Let us go off, and have a jolly little dinner at a restaurant, he proposed. There had been a time when such a suggestion would have surprised her to the verge of disapproval, but now she agreed to it at once. Oh, that would be so nice, she murmured with a great sigh of relief and assuagement. Jane had fulfilled her mission after all, as he had drawn them together at last. The reckoning, the marriage law of the new dispensation will be, thou shalt not be unfaithful to thyself. A discreet murmur of approval filled the studio, and through the haze of cigarette smoke Mrs. Clement Westall, as her husband descended from his improvised platform, saw him merged in a congratulatory group of ladies. Westall's informal talks on he knew ethics had drawn about him an eager following of the mentally unemployed, those who, as he had once phrased it, liked to have their brain food cut up for them. The talks had begun by accident. Westall's ideas were known to be advanced, but hitherto their advance had not been in the direction of publicity. He had been, in his wife's opinion, almost pusillanimously careful not to let his personal views endanger his professional standing. Of late, however, he had shown a puzzling tendency to dogmatize, to throw down the gauntlet, to flaunt his private code in the face of society, and the relation of the sexes, being a topic always sure of an audience, a few admiring friends had persuaded him to give his after-dinner opinions a larger circulation, by summing them up in a series of talks at the Van Sideren studio. The Herbert Van Sidrens were a couple who subsisted, socially, on the fact that they had a studio. Van Sideren's pictures were chiefly valuable as accessories to the mise-en-scene which differentiated his wife's afternoons from the blighting functions held in long New York drawing rooms, and permitted her to offer their friends whiskey and soda instead of tea. Mrs. Van Sideren, for her part, was skilled in making the most of the kind of atmosphere which a lay figure and an easel create, and if at times she found the illusion hard to maintain, and lost courage to the extent of almost wishing that Herbert could paint, she promptly overcame such moments of weakness by calling in some fresh talent, some extraneous reinforcement of the artistic impression. It was in quest of such aid that as he had seized on Westall, coaxing him, somewhat to his wife's surprise, into a flattered participation in her fraud. It was vaguely felt, in the Van Sideren circle, that all the audacities were artistic, and that a teacher who pronounced marriage immoral was somehow as distinguished as a painter who depicted purple grass and a green sky. The Van Sideren set were tired of the conventional color scheme in art and conduct. Julia Westall had long had her own views on the immorality of marriage. She might indeed have claimed her husband as a disciple. In the early days of their union, as he had secretly resented his disinclination to proclaim himself a follower of the new creed, had been inclined to tax him with moral cowardice, with a failure to live up to the convictions for which their marriage was supposed to stand. That was in the first burst of propagandism, when, womanlike, she wanted to turn her disobedience into a law. Now she felt differently. She could hardly account for the change, yet being a woman who never allowed her impulses to remain unaccounted for, she tried to do so by saying that she did not care to have the articles of her faith misinterpreted by the vulgar. In this connection, she was beginning to think that almost everyone was vulgar. Certainly there were few to whom she would have cared to interest the defense of so esoteric a doctrine. And it was precisely at this point that Westall, discarding his unspoken principles, had chosen to descend from the heights of privacy and stand hawking his convictions at the street corner. It was Una Van Sideren who, on this occasion, unconsciously focused upon herself Mrs. Westall's wandering resentment. In the first place, the girl had no business to be there. It was or Mrs. Westall found herself slipping back into the old feminine vocabulary simply or to think of a young girl's being allowed to listen to such talk. The fact that Una smoked cigarettes and sipped an occasional cocktail did not in the least tarnish a certain radiant innocency which made her appear the victim, rather than the accomplice, of her parents' vulgarities. Julia Westall felt in a hot, helpless way that something ought to be done, that someone ought to speak to the girl's mother. And just then Una glided up. "Oh, Mrs. Westall, how beautiful it was!" Una fixed her with large, limpid eyes. "Why, you believe it all, I suppose?" she asked with seraphic gravity. "All what, my dear child?" The girl shone on her. About the higher life, the freer expansion of the individual, the law of fidelity to oneself, she glibly recited. Mrs. Westall, to her own wonder, blushed a deep and burning blush. "My dear Una," she said, "you don't in the least understand what it's all about." Miss Van Sideren stared, with a slowly answering blush. "Don't you, then?" she murmured. Mrs. Westall laughed. "And not always or altogether. But I should like some tea, please." Una led her to the corner, where innocent beverages were dispensed. As Julia received her cup, she scrutinized the girl more carefully. It was not such a girlish face, after all definite lines were forming under the rosy haze of youth. She reflected that Una must be 26, and wondered why she had not married. A nice stock of ideas she would have as her dower. If they were to be a part of the modern girl's trousseau, Mrs. Westall caught herself up with a start. It was as though someone else had been speaking, a stranger who had borrowed her own voice. She felt herself the dupe of some fantastic mental ventriloquism. Concluding suddenly that the room was stifling, and Una's tea too sweet, she set down her cup, and looked about for Westall. To meet his eyes had long been her refuge from every uncertainty. She met them now, but only, as she felt, in transit. They included her parenthetically in a larger flight. She followed the flight, and it carried her to a corner to which Una had withdrawn, one of the palmy nooks to which Mrs. Van Sideren attributed the success of her Saturdays. Westall, a moment later, had overtaken his look, and found a place at the girl's side. She bent forward, speaking eagerly. He leaned back, listening, with the depreciatory smile which acted as a filter to flattery, enabling him to swallow the strongest doses without apparent grossness of appetite. Julia winced at her own definition of the smile. On the way home, in the deserted winter dusk, Westall surprised his wife by a sudden boyish pressure of her arm. "Did I open their eyes a bit? Did I tell them what you wanted me to?" he asked gaily. Almost unconsciously, she let her arm slip from his. "W what I wanted, why, haven't you all this time?" She caught the honest wonder of his tone. I somehow fancied you'd rather blame me for not talking more openly before. You've made me feel, at times, that I was sacrificing principles to expediency." She paused a moment over her reply, then she asked quietly, "Colin, what made you decide not to any longer?" She felt again the vibration of a faint surprise. "Why, the wish to please you," he answered, almost too simply. "I wish you would not go on, then," she said abruptly. He stopped in his quick walk, and she felt his stare through the darkness. "Not go on, call a hansom, please. I'm tired," broke from her with a sudden rush of physical weariness. Instantly his solicitude enveloped her. The room had been infernally hot, and then that confounded cigarette smoke. He had noticed once or twice that she looked pale. She mustn't come to another Saturday. She felt herself yielding, as she always did, to the warm influence of his concern for her, the feminine in her leaning on the man, in him with a conscious intensity of abandonment. He put her in the hansom, and her hand stole into his in the darkness. A tear or two rose, and she let them fall. It was so delicious, to cry over imaginary troubles. That evening, after dinner, he surprised her by reverting to the subject of his talk. He combined a man's dislike of uncomfortable questions with an almost feminine skill in eluding them, and she knew that, if he returned to the subject he must have some special reason for doing so. You seem not to have cared for what I said this afternoon. Did I put the case badly? No, you put it very well. Then what did you mean by saying that you would rather not have me go on with it? She glanced at him nervously, her ignorance of his intention deepening her sense of helplessness. I don't think I care to hear such things discussed in public. I don't understand you, he exclaimed. Again the feeling that his surprise was genuine gave an air of obliquity to her own attitude. She was not sure that she understood herself. Won't you explain? He said with a tinge of impatience. Her eyes wandered about the familiar drawing room which had been the scene of so many of their evening confidences. The shaded lamps, the quiet colored walls hung with mezzotints, the pale spring flowers scattered here and there in Venice glasses and bowls of old Sèvres, recalled, she hardly knew why, the apartment in which the evenings of her first marriage had been passed a wilderness of rosewood and upholstery, with a picture of a Roman peasant above the mantelpiece, and a Greek slave in statuary marble between the folding doors of the back drawing room. It was a room with which she had never been able to establish any closer relation than that between a traveler and a railway station. And now, as she looked about at the surroundings which stood for her deepest affinities, the room for which he had left that other room, she was startled by the same sense of strangeness and unfamiliarity. The prints, the flowers, the subdued tones of the old porcelains, seemed to typify a superficial refinement that had no relation to the deeper significances of life. Suddenly she heard her husband repeating his question. I don't know that I can explain, she faltered. He drew his armchair forward so that he faced her across the hearth. The light of a reading lamp fell on his finely drawn face, which had a kind of surface sensitiveness akin to the surface refinement of its setting. Is it that you no longer believe in our ideas? He asked. In our ideas, the ideas I am trying to teach. The ideas you and I are supposed to stand for. He paused a moment. The ideas on which our marriage was founded. The blood rushed to her face. He had his reasons, then she was sure now that he had his reasons. In the 10 years of their marriage, how often had either of them stopped to consider the ideas on which it was founded? How often does a man dig about the basement of his house to examine its foundation? The foundation is there, of course the house rests on it, but one lives above stairs, and not in the cellar. It was she, indeed, who in the beginning had insisted on reviewing the situation now and then, on recapitulating the reasons which justified her course, on proclaiming, from time to time, her adherence to the religion of personal independence. But as he had long ceased to feel the need of any such ideal standards, and had accepted her marriage as frankly and naturally, as though it had been based on the primitive needs of the heart, and needed no special sanction to explain or justify it. Of course I still believe in our ideas, she exclaimed. Then I repeat that I don't understand. It was a part of your theory that the greatest possible publicity should be given to our view of marriage. Have you changed your mind in that respect? She hesitated. It depends on circumstances on the public one is addressing. The set of people that the Van Siderens get about them don't care for the truth or falseness of a doctrine. They are attracted simply by its novelty. And yet it was in just such a set of people that you and I met and learned the truth from each other. That was different. I thought you considered it one of the deepest social wrongs that such things never are discussed before young girls, but that is beside the point, for I don't remember seeing any young girl in my audience today except Una Van Siderens. He turned slightly and pushed back the lamp at his elbow. Oh, Miss Van Siderens, naturally, why naturally? The daughter of the house, would you have had her sent out with her governess? If I had a daughter I should not allow such things to go on in my house. Westall, stroking his mustache, leaned back with a faint smile. I fancy Miss Van Siderens is quite capable of taking care of herself. No girl knows how to take care of herself till it's too late. And yet you would deliberately deny her the surest means of self-defense? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.